Want to give a quick plug for Mint Mobile. I've been talking about them a little bit in the last few weeks here. And basically, we switched after me freaking dragging my feet for a really long time. It turns out it's really easy to switch from a big carrier to any other carrier. It used to be really complicated to move your phone number and you had to pay for it and all this other shit. But now, it's super easy to switch. I moved over to Mint Mobile. I tested them out for like a week. My wife was not certain if like the service was going to be as good or anything like that. But turns out it's just fine. The thing is, we were paying like well over $120 per month for our previous service for both of us. And now it's way cheaper. It's only like $15 per month for each of us, a little over $30 per month. And for new customers, if you want to check it out and help support the show, you could check out Mint Mobile for, it's $15 per month for 3 months. You get to pay all at once. So it's $45, but basically super easy to switch. You could use your existing phone, whether no matter what phone you're using, you could use your existing phone and check it out. So if you want to save money, which I think we do, we don't want to just waste money. You can go to milehighfi.com/mint and check it out and see what deals they have going on. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. My name is Doug Cunnington, and today I'm sitting with my buddy, Rusty. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you, Doug?
I am awesome. I had quite a lot of caffeine earlier, so I'm ready to go. That's one of my secrets. So I feel good and I'm excited to get to know you a little bit more. Like, we've met and talked a handful of times, but never in depth. And you've been retired for 4 years, is that right?
Yep.
And we're going to talk about what everything's like post-FI. One or two cool things. Actually, there's like four or five. You moved to Colorado after retiring. You've had to navigate some pretty intense healthcare challenges.
Yep.
You apparently got two mortgages without income or jobs. Did I read that right?
Yeah.
Which seems crazy. And you have a withdrawal strategy, which I haven't heard of before, at least in the name that you sent over. So we'll talk about that and all these details about like life after financial independence and retiring. So welcome. I'm excited to just jump right in. So when did you first hear about FIRE and financial independence? Do you remember?
Well, it's a particularly apt story for this podcast, I feel, because my introduction was finding Carl. My wife and I were on a vacation in Scotland. It was around Labor Day 2018. At that time, I had a little bit of free time, so I was just kind of perusing the most read articles on the New York Times. And one of the ones that popped up was the, you know, a big FIRE article. I think probably like the first one that had really been in the New York Times about FIRE. And Carl is super prominently featured in that. I mean, he's kind of like the star. They have like a picture of him with his like hands on his hips and his chest out looking like Superman or something like that. So in connection with that trip, actually, my work just got furious at me for like, because I went on vacation for like 10, 11 days. And they were like, basically like, you can't do that. I mean, their attitude was basically like, you should never be going on vacation. And so it was like super inconvenient for them that I went on vacation, like my only big vacation of the year. So I got back. Work was just like, you know, being really big jerks to me. And I was like, F this. And then I went back kind of like a week later and I was like, what was that like FIRE thing that I read about? And so I did that, and I actually went and read like Carl's whole blog then front to back, since he had been so prominently featured in that article. And I came to my wife and I was like, I think we could like do this. And she was like, whatever helps you, you know, kind of like Carl's story where, you know, he was miserable at work and told Mindy about it. And she was like, hey, if that, you know, you know, you're miserable at your job. So that sounds way better than being miserable all the time. And so I got super into like the FIRE rabbit hole at that point then. And I was like, you know, I was like, we should do this. And so, got my wife more and more on board.
Okay. So that was 2018. Can you share your profession?
Oh yeah, I was an attorney. I was working at big law firms in Chicago.
So okay.
I worked there for, in the end, it ended up being around 9 years.
Yeah. Okay, nine years. Got it. Okay, and actually behind the scenes a little bit. So if you're watching on YouTube, you know that we're blurring out Rusty's face. If you're listening, you don't know that, but we're telling you, we're keeping this somewhat anonymous. So yeah. I won't like volunteer too much info. I'll let you share whatever you want. Sure. So just to let everyone know, that's the reason why I'm vague sometimes here. Okay. So 2018, you've been working there for a handful of years. How far, I mean, you must have been doing some things pretty right. So to be able to retire fairly quickly, right?
Yep.
So how long before you retired? Just a couple years? And what were you doing before to put you in such a position?
Yeah, it was like just a couple years from when we learned about fire to when we actually retired. And so the big things that we did well early on were just like avoiding debt, avoiding student debt. And the other thing is we met in college and we moved in together, right? You know, right after we graduated. So we were always splitting household costs. But probably the biggest thing was when we were getting ready to go to graduate school, I went to law school, my wife went to MBA. And, you know, you get offers to schools. You know, now it's super common to apply to like a bunch of schools. And then we both got full scholarships to University of Iowa, where I'm from, the state of Iowa. So we went and did that, and then did well in school and got good paying jobs. And then a lot of our peers, you know, like especially at the law firm, people have $200,000, $300,000 of student debt. And so to be starting out with zero, you know, mm-hmm. net worth of zero is actually like a great place to be in. So you're not making that, you're not making essentially like a mortgage payment right off the bat when you're starting out.
Got it. Okay.
And then the other big thing is, thankfully, my wife had a professor in business school, and it's like the standard financial analysis class that they have where you're valuing individual stocks and stuff like that. But he devoted one day to Vanguard and was just basically like, this is what you, just so you know, we're doing all this other stuff that like companies will pay you for.
Yeah.
But like when you invest, this is what you should invest in. And that was, basically that justified the whole 2 years of MBA for her, because just have that professor one day be like, here's Vanguard, it beats everything, you know. And he's talking to these people who are going to go be asset under manager advisors, and it's just basically like, but no, this is the cheat code for how you invest. So at the end of that first year of working, we had like $60,000 in just a bank account. And that's when my wife was like, we should do Vanguard. And I was like, I've never heard of it. And she's like, it's the best thing. So I like researched it just a little. And then I was finally like, hey, I'm on board with it. Like, you know, you appear to know this. Can you set it up? So she set it up for us.
You had whatever, 60K in the checking account. Were you also investing in like a 401k? And you guys probably made too much to do a Roth.
We were priced out of the Roth. Now knowing about the back door and stuff like that, there's stuff that we could have been doing that wasn't. So we weren't totally optimized. But my big thing off the bat was I really wanted flexibility. So I actually didn't do my 401k for the first couple years, because I was like, I want access to money in case of an emergency, or if we wanted to do a house or something like that. My wife had a match from her employer for her 401k. And so she started maxing out her 401k, and especially seeing that and the match, you know, seeing that she had the couple extra years in the match. I mean, she ended up so far ahead of me just starting a couple years later and not having a match. So it's another illustration of how if you start doing that stuff early, it just is so much more valuable.
Okay. And then do you think you were like a saver, you and your wife savers before? It sounded like you avoided debt. You came in thinking, okay, we want to have like a nest egg for emergencies, other stuff like that. It sounds like you were fairly conservative and forward thinking generally.
I was very debt adverse. My wife had $14,000 in student loan debt before we were married coming out of college. And I thought that was the most insane thing ever. I was super worried about that. Okay. So I was very irrationally debt adverse. And then when we were looking at graduate schools and some of them were going to be, you know, put us jointly $500,000 in debt versus, you know, having Iowa be like, you can come here for free. I was like, am I missing something? Like, would someone choose to go pay $500,000? I was like, that just seems, you know, crazy. That seems crazy. So I think early on, it was more of that, just like, avoid debt at all costs. Like, I think, you know, we lived pretty much the life that we wanted, but it just wasn't that expensive. And even just taking on big expenses too, like, you know, when we got married, we did it the way that we wanted to, but it only ended up costing us like, you know, $10,000, which at the time seemed crazy. And even to pay for that, I was like, we're going to save up all the money in advance. We're not going to take on any debt to do the wedding. And so we saved up the money to do the wedding. The first time we bought a car, I was like, we're going to save up all the money to buy the car in cash. So that was just kind of like our natural instinct. And I think that kind of really helped us save a lot of money, especially we started earning more money. And it was like, there's nothing I really wanted. We're living the life that we want to live. There's nothing else I really want to do with it. It just started accumulating in the bank account. And before I went to law school, I was a teacher. And so we had like a lower income. It's like when you like hiking, when you like cooking, you know, those are our main hobbies. Like those don't cost a lot of money. Right. And it's like, if I had more time, what would I want to do? I was like, I'd go on more hikes, or, you know, I'd cook more meals and stuff like that. So things like that just kind of led to, you know, once we had the higher income, we kept living the lifestyle that we wanted to live, and money just kept
stacking
accumulating. Yeah. And then you see what Vanguard does too. You see what the index funds do. And since we graduated in 2012, and I think it's been like, you know, above much better than historically. I think it's like 14% average annual return over that period. It was just like cool to see, like, well, this money grows so much. So it's kind of was extra incentive to be putting money away in there. And then, and then you find FIRE and it's like, oh, well, actually this money can do something even better. You can like buy your freedom with it, you know, by that. So,
okay. So you laid a good foundation here. Do you know, I'm just curious, you were fairly conservative money-wise. Is everyone in your family like that? Or like, where do you think you got that from? Because some people are not, they're more, you know, they want to spend more, or, I mean, everyone's different, but do you have any ideas?
I think I attribute it, a good amount of it, to just kind of like the culture of Iowa, where it's kind of like, you know, you work hard and you kind of like you save money, and like that's what things are valued. There's also not a good amount of showing off. I mean, there are definitely statusy people, I think, anywhere, but like the culture of Iowa is like, you kind of like, you get ahead more by just being friendly and nice and trying to connect with people. And there's not as much of that like competition for like, you know, there's not a Lamborghini dealership. There's not a Porsche dealership. The way that people still will drive around in trucks and things like that. You know, some of the things that maybe are a little bit more spendy, but I think that was kind of like what kind of, you know, grounded me in that. And you definitely like, I think you kind of alienate yourself from people too, if you're not like self-deprecating and modest and things like that. Yeah. So I think that's true everywhere, but it helps to grow up somewhere where it's like, I mean, I think it's almost like the anti-cool like place is like Des Moines, Iowa. It's like, you know, it's like used as like a punchline in a joke, you know, like,
2018, you found Carl's blog, you read a bunch. Did you reach out to him like pretty early on, or when did you first
connect
with him?
It was after I retired. I was kind of like, hey, I did this, and like your blog was the, you know, your blog was the thing that caused me to do this. So
that's cool. Carl's great. He gets, I mean, he's so nice, and I'm glad you reached out to him and everything. I think he appreciates hearing from folks.
Yeah.
So you retired in 2020, is that right?
Yep.
So what time of year, if we remember right, there was a pandemic in 2020. So
yeah.
How was the timing?
I retired in September 2020. It was a month before my son was born, which was kind of the goal, was to be retired. And it was nice to actually have, like, you know, a month totally off before he was there. So we took our nesting, like pre-kid nesting, to the next level, especially when it's like the pandemic and you can't go out. But the last like 8 months of work were pretty great because it was all remote work. And I knew that I wasn't going to be working long-term. So I was slacking off kind of to the extreme those last 8 months.
You had achieved a lot. You made it through law school. You did all a bunch of shit, right? So then you're like, all right, I am going to do less than what is, you know, expected, kind of.
It was great. I mean, the whole like last 2 years where I could have a little bit more of that like F you attitude were so like healing for me.
That's great.
And then especially the last 8 months, I was like, well, they said I've been working 8 years. I was like, I wasn't really allowed to take a lot of vacation. I was like, I basically have 8 months of vacation that I'm due. So kind of treated it like 8 months of vacation. And then, just the process of people asking me to do things and being like, I'm not going to do it on that timeline, or I'm definitely not working weekends at all, no matter what the, no matter what the occasion is. That was, it just felt so healing to, and kind of set the right tone for kind of like retirement. So, you know, because especially being at the big law firm, they're like, I need this and I need it done yesterday. And you're like, what's the real deadline? And they're like, yesterday. And so I'm mad at you that you're late. They're like, no, I, yeah. So, and then it's like, what's the timeline yesterday? And I'm like, well, give me a real deadline before I'll even start doing this. And then they were furious.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I love that. It's hard. There's not many people that can do that well. My wife, she struggled with slacking off. So like, even when she was at a point where she could and should have, and there were unreasonable expectations, like she still like played along with the game. So I love that you did what I tried to do. I eventually got laid off, but the thing I've heard, even from the audience here from MyLifeFi, they're just like, Doug, like your teammates are relying on you. And they, like, people were a little upset at me for slacking off, but I'm like, it's not my, like, it's not on my shoulders that the company has a weird culture. So like, how did you deal with it? Did you feel bad that like maybe your peers were thinking, hey, Rusty is a slacker now? Like, how'd you deal with that?
I really didn't. I also felt like I was actually doing them some long-term good, because I was like, I'm standing up to the, you know, these managers at the law firms, their partners. I was like, I'm standing up to the partners. I'm giving them some perspective that they need, that they can't just call people all the time and demand things immediately and expect people not to sleep or have a personal life or anything like that. So I felt like me being prickly, I mean, there might've been some short-term pain where they were like, well, we can't have Rusty do this. We're going to go to someone else and make them do it and make them their life miserable in the short term. But I was like, I think long term, they'll maybe be a little, you know, my peers would be a little bit better off, because they'd be like, well, we can't just treat people absolutely horrible all the time, because remember what happened with Rusty when he just started, when he had enough and started saying no and stuff like that. So
amazing. I'm going to steal that answer for the future, because you explained it in the right way. All right, so
I even actually had a conversation with like the head of my group at one point, and I explained to him why I was acting that way. And at the end of the conversation, he was like, well, you proved that you're a good attorney, because I'm actually kind of convinced that your way of doing things is the right way of doing things. So
yeah,
hopefully that made some of my peers' life a little easier in the long run.
Okay, so you moved out here to Colorado. What was the timeline on that? What brought you out here?
That was during our first year of retirement. We had friends who we had like kind of shared with them what we were doing. They were kind of like some of our best friends and the people we had been most open with. They lived in Santa Cruz, California, and we were always kind of like envious of their lifestyle. We were like, this is, you know, anyways, way better culture than Chicago. I mean, Chicago, you just work all the time, basically, and the weather's bad. So even when you're not working, you're like inside doing stuff. And so we'd go visit them in Santa Cruz every year. And we were like, this is really nice. Like the weather is nice. There's a beach, there's mountains. It's, you know, it's incredible. They were getting ready to move to Boulder. They wanted us to just kind of like weigh in on the financial stuff. And so they're like, is this a good financial move? Should we buy a house? Should we rent? And we were like, we did the analysis for them and we were like, actually, it's an amazing financial move. And in fact, we're going to look at buying a place in Boulder too. And so we were initially, our initial thought was like, well, let's move out there. We'll rent for 3 months and just, you know, kind of see if we like it. Cause we never even like been to Boulder before.
I was going to ask, have you been to the Front Range at all?
I've been to like Denver and Colorado Springs and stuff, but never specifically to the Boulder area. You know, it's like, it's always on those lists of like best places to live. And, you know, you just even like look up, you just Google Boulder and look at the pictures of it and it's right up against the mountains and everything like that. It's really enticing. And then we didn't have a car, you know, so the fact that Boulder is like always considered one of the best bike cities to really appeal to us. I guess that's another component of how we got to fire. never had a car.
Yeah, oh, you never did?
We had a car, never had a car in Chicago, I should say. Okay. But so for 10 years, we didn't have, didn't have a car.
Wow. And I guess it's normal. You could take a subway or
even taking Ubers was so much more cost effective. But the primary thing to get to work, I would normally bike and then we would walk home together and we just lived a couple miles from work. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
But what about the winter then? Because it is cold.
We just were like hardy, you know?
You would still...
I would just bundle up. I got one of those like Canada Goose jackets that are like super warm after like two winters of like toughing it out in my like beat up North Face jacket. It was like, it like had a tear in it. I just like taped over. But yeah, so... But yeah, not having a car for 10 years helped. And that was interesting too, because people were like, you guys take a lot of Ubers. That's expensive. And I was like, we don't own it way cheaper than owning a car. I was like, just to have a parking spot in our building was like $325 a month. And I was like, take almost unlimited Ubers for $325 a month and be way ahead. So
interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess like once you get used to the lifestyle, like there's a lot of convenience with it too. Cause like one thing I stress about even now, even just going to Boulder where there is like sufficient parking usually, but like parking stresses me out, but it's like, you don't have to worry about parking if you're going to a show or whatever. It's just like get the Uber and it's no insurance, maintenance. There's a million things.
If you're into like bike commuting, this Boulder County area, the infrastructure is just fantastic. They have the rec trails are separate from the roads and you have to be on the road a little bit. Like, you know, for us, it's about two blocks from our house to get onto the rec path. But then once you're on the rec path, you almost never even have to like cross the street. They have underpasses or bridges for the bikes and stuff. So Boulder County has lived up to that expectation.
It's pretty awesome.
But yeah, so we started looking at Boulder and we had heard, you know, just like heard things about how interest rates were low during the pandemic. But yeah, our friends being like, oh, should we, you know, rent by doing the analysis? And we didn't realize how low the mortgage rates were and that they were, you know, below 3%. You know, we ended up with like 2.7%. And that makes the decision to buy a house a lot, you know, a lot easier. So we looked at the rental market in Boulder and it's because it's a college town, it's kind of a super tricky rental market where there's a lot of stuff that's really beat up. Like, you know, looks like they've been having house parties for 20 years. And it was like, that's not where we really want to like bring our baby, you know? So my wife and I went on a walk one day, my son napped the whole time, thankfully. And I was like, hey, by the end of this walk, I'm going to convince you that we should buy a house in Boulder. And I laid out all the reasons and then we were done with the walk and she was like, all right, like basically like let's get inside and I want to like go look on Zillow and, you know,
That's awesome. Was it hard to find a place in Boulder?
It was just like during the COVID period, it was like things were selling immediately. Like the weekend they were listed, they were going. So kind of ruled out like going to look at places in person. So our friends who we had been talking to about moving to Boulder, they were already out there. So we sent them with their real estate agent to go look at the houses in person for us. And they would, you know, Zoom with us or FaceTime us in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that, I feel like it's been a while now. And we got our place in March of 2020. But I was going to say, like, as the pandemic went on and people were like at home more and like there wasn't much of a supply out there, that's when offers started coming in like 50 or 100K over asking price and like that sort of thing. Did you have to do that?
We, for Boulder, we found a place that was, had been overpriced and it was, had been on the market for like 7 months, even though everything was selling immediately. So we actually were very unusual in those circumstances because we negotiated them down on price, but it was just, they had a really kind of crazy number in their head, but we liked the house so much that we were like, it's worth trying to see if they'll come down and stuff like that. So I think we ended up getting it for kind of like the fair price. Like once our house sold, the other houses in our neighborhood sold for that like exact same number. So it was like, you know, kind of in line with what the market was going to be. But yeah, it was an unusual circumstance to be actually coming in below asking price and stuff like that. Our experience in Breckenridge was more like what you're describing.
Okay. Right?
12 offers opening weekend and stuff like that.
Oh, so, wow. You mentioned the Breckenridge place as well. So after 7-8 months of being retired, you moved from Chicago to Boulder. So you didn't have a job or a W-2. How'd you get the mortgage on the couple places?
So our experience trying to get a mortgage was, it was definitely not typical. And I think the mortgage brokers knew that. A lot of them would not even return an email or or a call. I was just trying to explain to them. I was like, I eventually just ended up saying to them, like, how do retired people get a mortgage? Like, that's like, we're, you know, essentially treat us like retired people. And so what they ended up doing, the couple of people that I ended up talking to, and there were literally only just a couple that ended up being even somewhat interested in potentially working with us. But they do an asset depreciation model for income, which is it's very similar to the 4% rule, only they use 5%. And then, so they basically take your net worth and then they take 5% of that. And that's your income for the purposes of getting the mortgage. But then we were buying literally just the average home in Boulder. But when you're in the city of Boulder itself, the housing prices are so high that ended up being a jumbo loan. And then with the jumbo loan, I guess they can't resell it. The bank has to hold it themselves. So then they really wanted to grill us on like our history and stuff like that. I actually ended up, the one that we ended up going with was this banker that my family, like that my dad and mom had used in Des Moines, who like knew us somewhat because he knew us like and knew that we were generally like financially responsible and things like that. I think he was, you know, he was more comfortable. He was more comfortable with giving us a loan and stuff like that. But
gotcha.
But I was like, oh, this is, especially, you know, with FIRE, it's always like DIY, do it yourself. These banks and financial people are the enemy. I was like, oh, maybe I've burned this bridge a little bit too thoroughly. And so it was actually nice to have someone who had some awareness of us. So
it's interesting, you know, on the entrepreneurship side, sometimes people don't realize it. It's like, oh, they're making a lot of money, way more than they were in their corporate job, but they're entrepreneurs. And you need to have like, I think 2 years of W-2s or some tax history, tax filings, and then they'll give you a mortgage because like you're paying taxes, you're earning money, whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, retired people buy houses. So how do they do it? It's like a fucking mystery. Like it's weird that they can't just be like, oh, okay, you're in this classification. We could treat you like this. Obviously, you look at the balance sheet. It's like, yeah, you could buy the house.
Right. I'm like, I could buy the house in cash. Like, yeah. I don't understand. But yeah, it's weird because it's like, you know, if we had had our incomes just a few months ago, even if we had zero money saved up and we're totally financially irresponsible, they'd be like, oh, you guys both have six-figure incomes. Like, how big of a house do you want? Like, let's get you, like, are you sure you don't even want a bigger one? You know?
Right.
But it's like, oh, you have a bunch of money. It's like, you have wealth. You're a riskier investment than someone who just earns a high income and spends it all. I was like, it's just a weird, weird financial system set up. And then I just out of curiosity, I asked the mortgage broker too. I was like, well, what if someone has a high income and a lot of money? Can they get a bigger mortgage? And they're like, no, you either do the asset depreciation or you do the income. You can't you can't combine the two. Which my brother who's out in Seattle, he was asking some of his friends about that. And he said it was actually really common for his friends to have trouble getting a mortgage because a lot of them they'd be like tech jobs and they'd have a lot of stock options, but not a lot of income. And they would get penalized when they would go to the banks. And I'm like that. Anyways, it's just a messed up.
Yeah.
It's a messed up system.
It just hasn't caught up to like whatever modern income sort of portfolio or makeup or whatever.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. So we have a sponsor today. That's Ghost Bed. And I have I'll show you upstairs, Rusty. It's the Ghost Bed Lux. Very soft. It's like sleeping on a cloud or something like that.
Yeah. Is that what you're sleeping on now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we got one. And you mentioned that you sleep really well now. And I'm guessing part of it is because you don't have the job. So how long did it take to sort of decompress and like start sleeping through the night? Because I mean, even when I got laid off, I would like have nightmares of emails that I could have gotten or whatever.
I still have those, which is kind of crazy. I mean, I'm actually like doing therapy to try to see if I can like rewire my brain to not get those like work email nightmares anymore. Yeah. It's a process. Like I said, it's still going on, but the biggest one was I'd just be so stressed at work. I'd not sleep well. I'd have a bunch of caffeine in the morning. I need like at least, you know, one or two drinks to kind of unwind at night. And even then I'd have, you know, and then I'd still have like some lingering stress from the day. So a few months after being retired, I stopped drinking the caffeine, which I think helped. And then kind of like over a course of a few more months, like kind of tapered off the alcohol because I didn't need alcohol as frequently. And now my general level of sleep is like super, you know, super good, but it takes a year plus of decompressing, I felt like, to get to that level.
Yeah. Are you still off caffeine these days?
Yeah.
Okay.
Still off caffeine. Yeah.
And I'll go off every now and then. Like I'll slowly taper the coffee that I'm making to usually it's like half calf and half decaf. And then occasionally I'll just like go all the way over to decaf. I'm trying to think if I actually like sleep a whole lot better, but I usually try to like not have too much, but I like caffeine. Like I said, I drink a bunch of it's the Monster energy drink, like zero sugar. There's probably crazy chemicals in there, but anyway, there's no sugar, but there's some caffeine and some other vitamins. But anyway, yeah, it's crazy how long the caffeine like sticks in your system, and everyone's different. But like, even if you just have a few cups, like it could last like through the whole day and impact your sleep.
Do you notice it? Like when you're tapered down on caffeine, do you feel like you're sleeping better? Or
sometimes there have been, most recently, not so much, but I think I have like cut down enough on the caffeine so it wasn't impacting me as much. But there were times when I would drink like whatever, like a liter of coffee like by 1 PM, and I would just have like so much in me that it would screw up my sleep. And then do you have any specific like sleep routines? Like do you go to bed at a certain time or anything like that?
Especially having a 4-year-old, like bedtime is very, you know, very kind of like set, and they go to bed pretty, you know, he goes to bed pretty early. So it's like around 8 o'clock, we'll be pretty much all wound down, have the lights off in the house and things like that. And then I have a sleep mask. I have a special knee pillow that I use. I've We have blackout curtains, humidifier, air purifier. So we stuff, kind of yeah. like create the perfect little sleep cocoon for ourselves. Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Very good. Yeah. All right. Well, you can check out. Well, the thing is, Ghostbed has a bunch of different mattresses. You can save 50% with the code MileHiFi. Check out or go to ghostbed.com/MileHiFi. And they have 101 night at home sleep trial. So you can test it out, make sure it works for you. Thanks a lot to Ghostbed. And we'll put a link in the description. So you mentioned you had to do some work on getting the first mortgage. I suspect the other one was a little bit easier because you knew the game to play.
And just called up the same bank too. And I was like, I just basically said, what's the max that you would let us borrow? and they gave us that number. And I was like, all right, well, that's our budget. And then I asked them, out of curiosity, I was like, what's your 30-year fixed rate mortgage mm-hmm. rate right now? And we got like 2.7% in Boulder. And then they said it was like 2.55 for Breckenridge. And I was just like, this is such a good opportunity. The other thing that was so crazy for us doing the analysis, because the New York Times has a really good rent versus buy calculator. Mm-hmm. If anyone's, you know, thinking about making the decision versus renting versus buying, it's like, it was super helpful. And I'd run the numbers in Chicago, maybe whenever we'd get an inkling that like there was a place we'd want to buy, I'd go run the numbers and they'd just be horrible in Chicago. There's not a lot of appreciation and the property taxes are like the second highest in the country in right. Illinois. And then you run the numbers in Colorado and there it's like Colorado is typically the second or third lowest in the country. And so you're like, it's like a half a percentage point is, or, you know, half a percentage point are the property taxes here. So at first I was like, am I doing something wrong? Like, are people grandfathered in? Like, will my property taxes be different than what this properties were historically? Yeah. And it's like, nope, just Colorado's better. It's just another way that Colorado's better. The property taxes were so low. The interest rates were so low. And we'd been thinking about maybe buying a second property after we bought the first property, just because we liked, you know, like the way all the numbers look. We'd been looking around Boulder and then we realized all of our, like everyone in our neighborhood was gone. It was like, you know, we'd been living here for a few months. The summer rolled around. Everyone in the Front Range kind of goes up to the mountains, you know, a lot. And we're like, where is everyone? They're like, we're in Frisco. We're in, you know, we're in Breckenridge. We're in Leadville, you know, wherever it is. We were like, oh, maybe we should look up there. And so we got the number from the bank. And then we, for what our max was to borrow. And we found a property that was a little bit over that. But I was like, well, we have all this money in the bank. It won't be an issue. We'll just like get the mortgage and then we'll just pay, you know, the down payment will be more than the 25% or whatever. And it turns out that's a horrible idea because of the asset depreciation or the model that they do. It creates like a death spiral where it's like you take a little bit out of your net worth and then you can't, you know, your 5% number goes down. So then you take a little bit more out of your net worth and then your 5% number goes down a little more. And so we had actually made a cash offer on the house. And I just told the banker, I was just like, is there any way you can stop this death spiral? And he was like, we'll get it. He's like, we'll get an exception for you. So, so he went and got an exception. I was like, oh crap, are we going to have to buy this house in cash? Like that screws up our whole analysis. So yeah, a good lesson to learn there. But, it was potentially a dangerous situation that we had put ourselves in.
I've seen the play. It's an awesome spot. Oh, it's really cool. Yeah. Absolutely beautiful.
Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like you're saying, I think you've heard Carl and I talk about, I mean, it's warm down here in the Front Range, like here in Longmont and Boulder or whatever. It's hot. It's like 100 and it's warm. It's warm. It cools off at night. But anyway, up in the mountains, it's freaking awesome. Like we had a friend, like rent a place up in Frisco for like a month in the middle of the summer. Yeah. And it's awesome to be up there. A lot of places you could hop on the bike trail, end up at other trails and do some hiking. And actually that leads me to maybe some of the lifestyle changes. So you were in Chicago, you guys were working really hard. Your family's growing. You moved out here. Probably had to meet some new friends. You knew a few people, it sounds like. But yeah, any big sort of lifestyle adjustments or big changes after you moved out here?
We moved out here. We loved hiking. Hiking was like our main activity. There's actually some decent hiking around Chicago. No one does it, but we were anomalies. We moved out here and we were like, oh, the hiking will be amazing. We'll be hiking every day. And we started out hiking, but then there's just such an outdoorsy culture here that it led to all these other things that still put you out in nature and, mm-hmm. but you're just, you know, using different muscles and moving your body differently and things like that. So this past summer, we did a ton of paddleboarding up in Frisco in particular. For listeners who don't know, there's the Dillon Reservoir. It's like the big reservoir. It's owned by the city of Denver, where they kind of get a lot of their drinking water, but it also provides this really nice recreational area. And Frisco, even though it's a mountain town, like their little town emblem is like sailboats on a lake, and yeah. they kind of really have a lot of great water sports. So we got a couple of inflatable paddle boards and take those out to the marina. And our 4-year-old was just like loving paddle boarding this yeah. summer. And so, and we actually saw you one of the days when we were out there paddle boarding unexpectedly.
Yeah. And for the people that listen a lot, this is like deep inside, but I think it's fun to share these things. So I was out with Brad Barrett and some friends, and Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, a couple other folks as well. And we were out paddleboarding. We were hanging out on the little beach there, and Rusty walked up. I was like, what are you doing here? And then I forgot, you know, Breckenridge is just up the street from right, Frisco. Right. It's like 15 minutes away. Yeah. Yeah. So it was crazy. We chatted for a while, and for you guys, you didn't know we were going to be around or whatever, but there's like all these fire bloggers and podcasters around.
Well, like, we just saw you and Brad, and Carl had mentioned that you guys were going to be up there. So yeah. I thought it was just you, but then, yeah. And then Mr. Money Mustache walks up and you're like, this is so weird. Like how much did that like New York Times article change our life? And I would have never
yeah.
realized when I first read that, like that so I'd be crazy. Living up in Breckenridge and running into like randomly running into all these guys whose, you know, work I had read and or listened to and stuff like that. So
yeah, yeah, pretty fun. So if people are passing by, just hang out by the reservoir. You never yeah. know who's gonna roll up. All right.
But yeah, and then like when we moved out here, I didn't know how to ski, and now okay. skiing's like my favorite activity. We had one year a couple years ago where I skied 59 days, which was, and you know, for someone who didn't grow up doing it, and I just learned how to do it as a 37-year-old. So yeah. that was cool. And then I bought a mountain bike when I was 38, learned how to ice skate last year when I was 39. So it's been super fun to have all those new activities.
Were you an athlete?
I was. I played football okay. in college. So
I was going to say, you're pretty coordinated, I think. Be tough for me to pick up all of those.
I feel like you could do it. I feel like you're Thanks. In good shape. I feel like you have the strength and balance and stuff. So I don't know.
I appreciate the confidence. Yeah. I skied some several years ago, but now that I'm older, I'm just like, you know what? The consequence of like me twisting my knee, I'm like, it's not worth it. I like hiking, snowshoeing's cool. I'll get out there like in any season, but I'm aware of my limitations. I probably hold myself back, but
yeah,
I don't know. I'm a baby.
It's really nice to be, it was nice for me to be able to learn doing it when I was, you know, whatever, quote unquote retired. Cause it's like, I didn't feel any rush to be like, I only have 5 days this year. I booked, you know, booked the yeah. vacation. I only have 5 days. I, you know, have to try to cram it all in. I just kind of went out there. And I spent like my first 3 days on the bunny hill, whereas, you know, a lot of people try to go do bigger runs and stuff like that. And I was like, I'm just going to make sure I'm totally comfortable yeah. with everything. So, yeah.
And side note, so Elizabeth retired like 6 months ago and she set up some different activities. And I think, you know, one thing that traditionally age retirees like run into, one of the issues is they stop learning, they stop doing new stuff, and they kind of sit at home. But we're so young, in air quotes, we're so young yeah. that it's really, you know, pretty, we want to do more stuff, but it keeps your mind active. You're doing like more, like different activities that you haven't done before. And you probably didn't, you weren't thinking that intentionally, but it's just like, it's really important for us to keep our minds active. And do you have any comments on that? No, pure question.
Well, you see the research about like neuroplasticity and longevity, and it's basically like learning how to do a new physical skill is one of the best things you can do for your mind. You know, you think of it as just being something that's going to benefit your body, but it, you know, in addition to having all those benefits for your body, it also gives your mind, and especially something like skiing where, you know, you get on the skis the first few times and you feel so uncomfortable. And then, you know, you fast forward 3 years and you're like, oh, I'm very comfortable with this now. And I'm moving my body in ways that I didn't do it before. I'm like, I'm sure there's all sorts of new neural connections. And then you just see it out in Summit County. One of the Summit Counties where Breckenridge and Frisco and these places are. But I think it has like the second longest life expectancy in the country. And one of my ski instructors was like, he was like 74 or 76, and he was like skiing down the mountain backwards and stuff like that. I was like, if you ever wanted to make the argument that like skiing was good for longevity, just go look at like all these, you know, 70, 80 year olds out on the mountain in Breckenridge. So
that's crazy. Well, and it makes a lot of sense too, because of the balance that you have to have and be able to like get up from the ground in a slippery situation. A lot of people know old people that fall down and what is it? Like they break their hip and then they die of pneumonia or whatever, like a year later.
It's how my grandpa died. So it feels like very apt for me. I'm like, he essentially died because he lost his balance and fell. And then, you know, year of health complications after that. And so, to be out there and doing something that works on your balance, I'm like, this feels very relevant and good on all those levels. And it's so nice to, because I grew up playing football, I just spent so much time in the gym and lifting weights and stuff like that. And I still like it, but I like it more as like a one day a week type thing. And it's nice to feel like, you know, in the summer, I want to be, I like feel compelled to get out and mountain bike and paddleboard and do hikes and stuff like that. And if you're doing that 5 days a week and you supplement with 1 day of weightlifting, it feels a lot different than when I was just trying to go, you know, force myself to go to the gym 6 days, six days a week. And then in the winter to want to be out skiing. And we were just up there for Veterans Day weekend. It's like opening day for Breckenridge, but it's like, I went out and skied 4 days in a row and my legs were just like so sore. It's like a week later now, my legs are like still a little bit sore from, you know, early season skiing. And I'm like, but I didn't have to force myself to like, you know, the way I would to go do like leg day at the gym. So.
All right. A big topic here, healthcare. So you mentioned to me that you hit your out-of-pocket max 3 of the 4 years that you've been retired. Can you talk about some details if you want to share, and then also how you approach, you know, the insurance, the planning, any other details?
Yeah, just like a few observations is the healthcare landscape has changed so much just even since we, you know, retired in 2020. The first year we did it was before a lot of the like ACA subsidies went into place, and the out-of-pocket cost was just like so much higher before that happened. The first year we didn't get any subsidies at all, especially because you have income. Sounds like actually you and Elizabeth are in a similar situation.
Yep, right?
But yeah, for listeners who don't know, it's like you know your income for the year is what determines what subsidy you get. So if you've worked half the year and you've earned a good income, you don't get much subsidy. And then the second year, it was before the subsidies were really raised a lot. So our premium was very high. And we, because of the health issues we had in the family, we knew we were going to be hitting our out-of-pocket max. So you sign up for a platinum plan. But it's, you know, what you also realize too is hitting those out-of-pocket maxes. It's, you know, if your net worth is, you know, over $1 million, you know, like a lot of people who are trying to retire, it takes a hit and it stings, but it's, you know, it's not the end of the world. And what we've seen with our out-of-pocket max is that we end up spending around like $25,000 to $28,000 a year on those years. And that's definitely more than we budgeted for, but it's not the end of the world. And if it's like the last few years and the stock market does better than expected, it does not really, you know, knock us off the path. And then, you know, going forward with the healthcare stuff, it's, we have a pretty good feel that some years we're going to be hitting our out-of-pocket max. And if you do that, you sign up for the, you know, the platinum plans through the marketplace. So you have a higher monthly payment, but then you have a lower out-of-pocket max. You know, we just do that. The other thing that we found that's super helpful is we just have a health insurance agent here, and their only incentive is basically to sell you a plan through the marketplace, but they help you navigate the marketplace really well and find the, you know, we have a few providers in particular that we want to make sure we have, and they make sure that those are covered. And then the other big thing that we found out, especially moving from Illinois to Colorado, is just like not all the state marketplaces are created equal at all. It was even with the subsidies that kicked in later on, the Illinois marketplace was almost double the cost of the Colorado marketplace, and the coverages were worse. Like here in Colorado, we're able to get in with, you know, if we pick the right plan, we can get in with whatever provider we want, essentially. And Northwestern University is like the big hospital in Chicago, and there were essentially none of the marketplace plans that would get us in with the providers we wanted at Northwestern. So it was just like, all right, you're kind of screwed here. That was a big one. When we had some providers, we had appointments, and then we showed up and they were like, oh, we don't accept your insurance, and it was for some somewhat urgent things. And anyways, it just made it a little bit easier when we were leaving Illinois to be like, we're paying less income tax, we're paying less property tax, and we're going to get better health insurance. You know, it was like, we were like, sorry, like Illinois, you kind of did this to yourself.
So that's rough. Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, you're exactly right. With Elizabeth and I, like, she stopped working after a few months this year. So yeah, no subsidies. But next year, I think we may be in that, you know, sweet spot where, you know, we'll get it a little bit.
Yeah. And so, and the subsidies have been really, they're really significant now. Like the cost of insurance has gone down a lot. So if we were just paying our premium and didn't have to get a platinum plan, you know, we'd be talking about for a family of three, just about like $500 a month, which is, you know, which would be something you can budget for. It's right. not make or break, especially when I hear people saying like, I can never retire early because of health insurance. It's like, well, things have changed, you know.
Yeah,
we get health insurance, we feel like it's good, and we feel like it's affordable.
Up next here is the withdrawal strategy, which I think, you know, someday soon I need to do like an episode. I think this is a popular topic, and people do it a little bit differently, and there's different options, and you can make it really complicated or not. But you mentioned the buy, borrow, or die. What does this mean?
It's a buy, borrow, then die. But buy, borrow, die is like, I guess just to preface it, it's like unanimously what wealthy people like billionaires use. And if you Google like buy, borrow, die billionaires, they'll be like, how do billionaires cheat the tax system and never pay taxes and stuff like that? And I used to read those articles, and my reaction, which I think is what most of them are going for, is like, you're like a little bit outraged. Like this is a horrible system. It needs to be closed. And then read those one of those articles popped up again post-retirement. And I was like, well, what does this actually entail? And so I looked into it and I was like, oh, this, like the tax benefits of this are amazing. So what you do is you basically use your assets as collateral to get loans. And then instead of selling your assets and paying capital gains, you take out a loan and then you pay the interest on the loan, but then you don't, because a loan is, you know, a liability instead of an asset, you don't actually end up paying any taxes. And so Interactive Broker has a really good option. I think they have the lowest rates that I've been able to find. Not like that they're plugging or sponsoring this, but their rates are just like so much lower than the big banks. Yeah, you take it. Yeah, we started out, we were retired, we were selling assets to pay for things, and now taking out loans. And the loans, when we started out, we were getting some fixed rate 7-year loans that were like below 3%. So really, really great interest rates. And especially then we're not selling S&P 500 stocks. And so if you just, especially for our first 4 years, you know, the S&P 500 these past 4 years has been up double digit percentage points every year. So paying a 3% interest loan is a lot better. And then getting to keep those assets growing for you, it's, you know, it's 7 percentage point delta. So it's like getting an extra 7 percentage points a year. And so that's, so the buy portion of buy, borrow, die is you buy stocks. The borrow is that you leverage your stocks to get liquidity, to get cash to pay for things. And then the die portion is you get a step up in basis when you die, as you know, people in the FIRE community are probably generally aware. So you've borrowed money the whole time. Your stocks have appreciated that whole time because you haven't had to sell any of them. And then at death, you get a step up in basis, and then you never end up paying capital gains tax the rest of your life.
Got it. Okay. What are, like, what could go wrong with it, right? Because there's no free rides.
So you were exposed to more risk. If you, you know, if you sell a stock and you take the cash, then you don't, it's just a simple, clean transaction. It's like, I need money. I sold a stock. I have cash. I went and bought whatever thing I was going to use that cash to buy. So you can get called on your margin loans. For S&P 500, they'll let you borrow up to 85% of your value. But then, like, let's say you have, you know, let's say 50% leverage on your stocks and the stock market drops 50%. That's not quite what the math is, but, you know, just, you know, to use round numbers, they would call you and you'd be forced to sell your stocks when they're, you know, depressed, at a low valuation. Yeah. But the, you know, for us, it's just like, well, we're not going to get up to that 50% leverage, you know, and especially since our stocks have been growing a lot faster than the interest rate, it's like, we actually find our margin has been, you know, our, you know, how much the stock market would have to drop has been that the number that it would have to drop has been increasing. So we're just safer and safer. But if you have it in your mind that you're never going to be above 30% leveraged or something like that, then, you know, you'd have to have a 70% stock market drop or something like that to get wiped out. So,
and I think Carl did this when they bought the other house, right?
Okay.
Do you remember that?
I don't know that, but
pretty sure. And I think it was like, was it a couple years ago? The market was down like 20%, something like that. Was it 2022? Is that
right? Oh yeah.
So yeah, we had, you know, it's been great years, but there was like one blip.
Right.
And I think the timing was just off for them. So I think he did have to, I mean, they were in a fine position, but it was like two or three things went wrong. And he was like, all right, I got to plan a little bit more.
Yep.
So people could listen back to the archive and someone will remember.
Oh, like he got like close to being called on. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just, bad timing and like,
But
that's what could happen.
That's where, so I think, you know, bringing this full circle too, I started out talking about how I was so scared of debt, like most of my life, you know, even, and then now to be like, you know, we're taking out leverage all the time. Like we're taking out debt, but it's just, especially it's been a total mindset shift, but it's kind of like, I do think it was a very good strategy to have early on to like live within our means, you know, not get used to living within our means, train that muscle really well. But then now it's like, you know, you plug in numbers into the spreadsheet and we're like, the expected value on this is millions of dollars higher over a decade than this other thing. And anyways, it's been a lot of like self-work to kind of get to that point, you know? And now, if you would have told me 15 years ago though, that I'd be like, oh yeah, you have two mortgages and you're taking, you know, you're taking on more debt like every month to pay your bills and stuff like that. I've just been like, oh my God, what went wrong?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like,
interesting.
It's actually, been beneficial.
All right. Well, we got to wrap up. We're going to go grab some lunch here after that, but there's an interesting thing, right? So you got to play some Boulder, you got Breckenridge. So what does like a typical year look like? What, like, do you go back and forth? Like you ski some, but you get out of the heat in the summer.
Yeah, that would be, so there's the ideal of what we'd like to do and then just kind of like what happens because of different life circumstances and stuff like that. But we lived, mostly in Boulder for like the first 15 months that we were out here in Colorado. And even after we bought Breckenridge, we were kind of like doing some home repair stuff on it. So it wasn't, we weren't up there using it as much. And then we kind of like switched our strategy and went and lived up in Breckenridge for 15 months and did more renovations on Boulder. Mm-hmm. But doing both those things was really nice because 15 months someplace you kind of like establish community and make friends and stuff like that. And you also get a really good feel for like how it changes throughout the seasons, especially mm-hmm. places like the Front Range and the mountains that change so much, yeah. you know, from like month to month. I think this year will be more of like our kind of what we hope would be like a typical year going forward. And so we'll spend like 2 months of the ski season up in Breckenridge, spread out a little bit, you know, some different weeks here and there, as spend a couple weeks over there for Christmas and New Year's. For the summer, spend 3 months in Breckenridge, July, August, September. Mm-hmm. September is amazing. Like yeah. that time I ran into you this summer, it was like the week after school had started on the Front Range. So there's like no one up there, but the weather is still perfect. Mm-hmm. So
it was amazing.
Yeah, that's a great time to be up there. Yeah, have the rest of the year in Boulder. And then we're going to go to Mexico for 2 weeks in January and okay. just get some warm weather and vitamin yeah. D for a couple weeks. But yeah,
that's awesome. And then did you catch much of the fall foliage? I felt like this year was amazing.
It was such a long fall. Like yeah. the leaves stayed around forever. We did. And so we get like two falls because you kind of like end of yeah. September, early October, it's fall in Breckenridge. And then like mid October, November is like fall down yeah. here. But fall and spring in the Front Range are perfect. Like yeah. the weather is so nice. It's sunny. When the leaves are changing, it's, you know, it's so, mm-hmm. so pretty here. And then summer in Breckenridge is great. So that little spring Front Range, summer in the mountains, fall
yeah.
Front Range, that little sequence that we have gives us like 7 months of perfect weather, which yeah. makes the year really nice.
All right. Well, we covered probably like 80%. So maybe we'll have to table some of this stuff. And okay. we could do some more in the future. But Rusky, it's been amazing. Really fun conversation. You are, you're off the radar. So yeah. people can't yeah. follow you anywhere, right?
Yeah. Okay. If you really want to get in touch with me, you can send Doug an email. He can forward it to me. But
yeah. send it to Carl.
Send it
to Carl at Mile High Fi. We'll just send it to his email address. But occasionally, not too often, but occasionally, you show up at HQ events. So yeah. if someone happens to go by someone's one of those, here, they yeah. might bump into you there.
Yeah. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. You listened to the show,
yep.
which is mm-hmm. cool. And you mentioned that you had sort of a vision of what my house might be like. You know, Carl talking about the basement and all this stuff. So what's your impression when you came in?
Well, the house is all put together and complete. I guess maybe, you know, hearing Carl on the podcast and talking about all the ongoing house projects that he has. Yeah. And then having seen your basement and just knowing that it was unfinished from, you know, briefly seeing it on YouTube and stuff like that, I thought maybe I would anticipate that. But yeah, you're in like a new neighborhood. You're you have all, you know, it seems like you have the whole house done and completed and everything like that. So
we have knobs on every door.
You have knobs on every door.
Unlike Carl's place. He's not here to defend himself. No. So it's easy to make fun.
We did it. We saw Carl and Mindy's house just this weekend, actually though too, but his is a lot more complete than, you know, he lets on. So yeah. I did notice there weren't knobs on the door, but yeah.
It's only a couple of them. Like the front door, there's a knob. I don't know about the rest of them, but yeah, Carl's place has come a long way. Like they finished a lot more in the kitchen. And like, if you saw it before, you'd be like, oh wow, this is really amazing. So, but yeah, I appreciate you saying that. You know, downstairs it is I'm a little messy. You can see my desk over there. That's the real deal. There's just a bunch of junk laying over there, like a million post-it notes, like 40 pens, half consumed cup of coffee over there. But upstairs, like when we have people over, it's kind of good to have guests show up because like I clean the counter. It's like you got to clean up and make it look like you're not a slob. Yeah, like clear the counter, throw all the dishes like into the sink, at least so it's hidden, or in a closet. It doesn't even matter where it's at. It's just like hide the stuff.
Yep.
So.
And then what is out stands out. I noticed you had the St. Bernardus coaster out there. Is that one of your favorites?
It is one, especially like this time of year. It's a little for people that don't know, like we're recording this a little early, but it's just a couple weeks before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And this time of year, it's like, it's gotten cooler. It's dark. It's great to pop open the St. Bernardus 12. So are you a St. Bernardus fan too?
Love St. Bernardus for similar reasons. It's my wife's favorite beer actually. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Belgium for Thanksgiving one year and drank Belgian beers the whole time. And they actually don't have Thanksgiving at that time of year. It's just set up for Christmas. So it's like early Christmas. So this beginning of the season with like Thanksgiving leading into Christmas is like the perfect time to have some of those rich Belgian beers.
Yeah. So. You know what, man? I'll give you, remind me before we go upstairs. So I homebrew beer. I made roughly a clone of like the App 12.
Oh yeah.
In 2018, back in Bozeman, and then I like caged and corked it. It's in a 750 bottle. I'll have to show you how to open. I put the corks in a little too far.
Okay.
But anyway, they're pretty good. It could be, that's several years old. So like, I think the head retention is down a little bit, mm-hmm. but it should be pretty rich, and a darker beer can like deal with oxidation a little bit. When you were over there, did you have like some of the vintages where they're like, oh, here's one from like 10 years ago or whatever?
We didn't do that. They would do, when we lived in Chicago, they would do the vintages for the Bourbon County, KBB, Goose Island.
Yeah. KBC, is that, what is it?
Oh, that's Kentucky Stout. Yeah. Okay,
different, got it.
Okay. We'd go over to Michigan though too. Yeah. I mean, yeah, those are fun stouts to have.
Man. We could just talk about beer the whole time, but this is good for the sound check.
You'll have to start a third podcast. Just have people over and talk about which beers they like.